Hey, pal, this is good. You're coughing up a storm.
Right. I know, man. It just started, too. I'm feeling better. I still sound a little scratchy, but I mean, I can always use the bass in my voice, so it works out. Man. Yeah, I was talking to Christian, and his wife kind of had the same thing. Like, I went to urgent care. It was bronchitis, and, like, I feel great. I feel fine, but it's, like, just this weird, like, chest cough. He said his wife had the same thing. It was, like, a month of it. It wouldn't go away. Mm.
That sucks, man. Get well soon, everybody.
It's all good.
Dude, I know I might have to just start a freaking true crime podcast. I talk about my obsession with true crime quite often lately.
Yeah, you do.
But I need to make sure we draw a line in the sand real quick. You know, I feel like sometimes whenever you're like, oh man, yeah, I'm into it too. I don't know if we're talking about the same thing. I'm talking about, like, I will watch these YouTube videos where, like, whoever's YouTube channel it is will be kind of explaining what was going on. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they're showing, like, either they're playing the audio from the 911 call, which, I gotta be honest, isn't my favorite part. It's a little tough.
Yeah, it's tough.
Except for whenever it's, like, the killer, and they're like, oh my gosh, you have to... And then you find out later that was the person, and then you're like, God, what a fake son of a gun.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, right.
And then they'll show, like, my favorite part is when they are in the interrogation room and, like, watching it all go down, man, where, like, there's the detectives in there. Mm-hmm. They're, like, being, like, good cop, bad cop stuff. And then this person, you get to actually see, of course, the footage is relatively grainy, but you get to actually see this person, like, go from, like, I don't know what you're talking about, to the, and it's always, like, the same lame excuse. They're like, she used to punch me in the face. And they're like, excuse me, what'd you say? She punched me in the face. They're like, yeah, I mean, did she hit you? Like, is that what happened? And then they kind of get them to sort of begin to admit it. And then there's this, like, trail of, like, at first it's this, and then it gradually, like, the person that committed the heinous act basically finally admits it, you know? And I don't know, man, watching those detectives kind of, like, get that, pull that information, put the clues together. I guess it goes back to my love for the one, the only, the man, the myth, the legend, Columbo.
Yeah. Still never seen a single episode.
God, it's the best.
Yeah, I'm into all that stuff. I especially love when, like, you know, there's sort of the, you know, whether it's like the docuseries or show, true crime or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like the detectives are telling you, like, well, we found out this, this, this. And so you know that the detective already knows something. And then watching the interrogation room where it's like, mm-hmm. where it's like they catch him in, like, the lie or whatever.
Oh, yeah, man.
That's so great. Mm-hmm. I also love when, I really love, it's kind of a niche thing, I guess, but I love when, you know, something happened in, like, the 60s or 70s and then it becomes a cold case. Nothing's happened for years. And then some detective that was like, you know, maybe he's retired or maybe he is, like, you know, about to quit. And then he's like, hey, we have, like, DNA technology now that maybe we may be able to, solve this thing. And, like, dude, that stuff's amazing, dude.
The concept of the detective that it just, like, they're like, it bugs them to death.
Yeah, right.
Until they solve it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that whole thing is just... it happens in real life, dude, and it's fantastic, you know?
Yeah, I would imagine that these guys are kind of like we are with, like, the things that we sort of become fascinated.
Obsessed
with. But for them, it's sort of more like real life, and it's like, hey, if I complete these challenges and, like, beat this game, it means, like, justice for the person that was...
Yeah, right. You know. That's one less, like, crazy bad guy on the loose. That's justice for the victims. That's... it's got to be, like, equal parts torturous and not necessarily, like...
it's like vindication or...
Yeah, I mean, like, it's...
What
like,
word are we
torturous and, like... satisfying, but satisfying doesn't, like, that's not,
yeah,
like, that doesn't have enough gravity,
right?
You know, it's, I don't know. Look, dude, I'm really excited about the topic today, so let's get to it.
Was
Welcome back, folks, to your favorite podcast, That Would Be Rad, the podcast that majors in 80s and 90s nostalgia, comic culture, all things paranormal, and minors in retro video games, tabletop RPGs, pre-internet mysteries, and raising our kids to be half as cool as we were back in the 80s. I'm your host, Tyler Bentz, and this is your other host,
Woody Brown.
Hey, dude.
Hey, man.
I beat you again. Look, man, I know that you have this amazing topic.
Mm-hmm.
But I recently rewatched something, and I kind of want to get into it a little bit. It's not going to be long, but is that okay?
Well, I'll allow it.
Thanks, pal.
I trust you.
Thanks, pal.
Go for it. Welcome to season three.
Welcome to season three.
Nothing changes. No, I'm kidding.
So I recently watched the first season of True Detective, and it's one of my all-time favorite shows of all time. Season two.
All-time favorite shows of all time. Okay, I was just trying to figure out what you were saying.
I had to double up on
that.
It's
a lot of all-time.
I mean, I like it enough. Maybe it's worth the double.
I haven't seen it since it came out, but I do remember loving
it. Man, it's so good, dude. It has like those elements of sort of like obscurity, and there's like little ties to like folk horror and maybe even like cosmic horror, sort of a Lovecraftian kind of thing. Anyway, I've all that to say, it's just as good as it was whenever I first watched it. If you haven't seen it, guys, go watch it. It's on HBO. It's definitely not for kids, so know that going in. There's some intensity to it. But I bring that up because there's sort of a theme that keeps coming up on that show, and you'll hear him talk about the King in Yellow. You'll hear the term Carcosa brought up, the Yellow King, Carcosa. So that is a topic that is so sort of obscure and weird. There's, tons of sites dedicated to this. But even after all of this sort of like all of these examples of like what this thing is, it's still just this kind of thing that's just like, it's like never ending. I know I'm not making a lot of sense here. So here's what I found about the King in Yellow. So if you know anything about the King in Yellow, you'll know that the character and the play of this name are not supposed to actually exist. They're fictional creations from the pages of a real book of the same name. This quote-unquote real version of the King in Yellow was written by Robert W. Chambers, a once-renowned author of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, whose work has on the whole faded into obscurity pretty much. The King in Yellow is his most popular and recognized work, published in 1895, and it featured a series of short stories and poems. They're kind of hard to categorize, but, in retrospect, looking back, they're regarded as like a pretty important early landmark in, back then it was called weird fiction. I would almost go on to say even cosmic horror a little bit. The opening stories of the book concentrate on this mysterious and horrific play. And like in these stories, like the characters fall victim to the play. So basically, the first act, and it's also looked at as like a script of like the King in Yellow. Like I said, it's a fictitious play. So you would read the first act and it would lure you in. And then by the second act, it would drive you mad. Or drive you insane, and we're talking suicide, and like it would just make you go nuts. His writing style hinted at this sort of great mythology behind just four little short stories. He sort of seeded these with these tiny like allusions here and there to shadowy figures, alien places, strange artifacts, and terrible gods. To clouded lakes and dark stars, to death reanimated and ancient, implicable evil and madness pushing in through the walls of the world. All of that sounds a whole lot like H.P. Lovecraft. And that's why I think a lot of this is so fantastic and so like fascinating. So the King in Yellow, like I said, again, it's like very, he would just sort of throw things out without sort of explaining a whole lot.
You mean like the short stories wouldn't connect kind of thing? Or
well, so people say like the original book, as a whole, you know, there were like a whole bunch of stories, but the King in Yellow themed stories, or where the King in Yellow is mentioned, is only really in the first four stories. Mm. But, you know, they say that like the entire book, I've never read the whole book. I have read a few of the short stories, the first four, but basically, like, you know, it turned into this big thing. He kind of became like a big deal. But what was weird about it is like the mysteries of this ancient land, Carcosa, which he talks about, the king in yellow, the yellow king, and his yellow sign, that's like another thing, have pretty much, that was like kind of it. You know, he did that book, and then for whatever reason, he never talked about him again. He moved back into like romance fiction and stuff like that, which is really bizarre. And then you would find out also that he actually got those topics from a guy named Ambrose Bierce, who actually wrote these other short stories even further back in 1886. He wrote a book or a short story called An Inhabitant of Carcosa, where Ambrose Bierce was like a Civil War soldier. And, you know, he wrote a lot of like fiction, but a lot of war stories, you know, because he was in the war. And so he was an infantryman. And so he knew all that intimately. Well, he would go on to randomly write this book called An Inhabitant of Carcosa in 1886, where this soldier is wounded in battle. He, you know, I don't know if it's like a coma or whatever, but he wakes. And when he wakes up, he's in this ancient land, forgotten land called Carcosa. Mm. He would also write a book or another short story called Hyta the Shepherd.
You're still talking about Ambrose Bierce?
Yeah, Ambrose Bierce. Yep. He would go on to write Hyta the Shepherd in 1891, where he would talk about this god called Hastur. And he was sort of this, in that story, he was sort of a benign god of shepherds. So then, you know, like I said before, Robert W. Chambers wrote The King in Yellow. And then after that, H.P. Lovecraft would go on to write a book in 1931 called The Whisperer in the Darkness, where he talks of Hastur as, he refers to him as, you know, one of the great old ones. And I guess like the King in Yellow character is like the avatar. And so, so H.P. Lovecraft and Robert Chambers and Ambrose Bierce, it's like they just throw these things out. Like there's just this massive amount of mythology surrounding them. And then I think what's cool about it is like these, and I don't know if it was more common back then, like it was okay to kind of like take something from another author and then just sort of expand on it, you know? But I don't know. I think it's really cool.
That is cool. I mean, I don't know if you remember this, but we briefly talked about Ambrose Bierce, God, one of the Halloween specials a long time, or maybe it was when we were talking about the Battle of Chickamauga, because he wrote a story about
that.
And also, I think I wanted to kind of dive into the mystery behind his life, because I think there's some interesting stuff about him. He like disappeared.
Yeah, he mysteriously disappeared. Like, yeah, which is
weird.
Again, it's like it just continues this sort of folklore where these characters are popping up, and it's like there's just sort of no explanation to it. Apparently, Lovecraft read the book in 1927, The King in Yellow, and was so enchanted that he immediately basically added those elements into his own creations, which is why, you know, in 1931, a few years later, in The Whisper in the Darkness, he would bring up Hastur as one of the great old ones, one of the old gods, which, you know, a lot of people look at that book as like the beginning of the cosmic horror genre, you know?
Yeah.
In 1938... a guy named Raymond Chandler, he was like he would write like noir and like detective books. And he wrote a short story called The King in Yellow, which was about this this mysterious death of a famous jazz trumpeter that was found in a yellow robe and yellow pajamas. So it's like this weird theme that like keeps coming up. Here's what's really weird. So when I knew about like the H.P. Lovecraft, and I'd heard about the King in Yellow stuff. But when I first saw True Detective, and the first time you hear like the Yellow King, the King in Yellow, I was immediately drawn back to probably eighth grade, I had a teacher that was fantastic. And she made me, or she gave me a book of short stories and was like, you got to read this. And so there was this story that like moved me so much, but I could never remember the name of it. What's weird about it is I would go on to find that that short story was called The Yellow Wallpaper, which oddly enough, I would find in doing my research into this now after, you know, rewatching True Detective, that was actually inspired also by this, the King in Yellow sort of like mythos.
Mm-hmm.
So in True Detective, you know, you would see, you know, for those that have seen it, you know, you would see like a little symbol and that's called like the yellow sign. And so the yellow sign was sort of a vision or like symbols, you know, that the god Hastur would sort of deliver to his worshipers. But the thing is like that yellow sign would always lead to their downfall and their death, which is interesting in True Detective, because if you look at it sort of figuratively, the little circle motif or the spiral motif, that would probably kind of be the personification of like a yellow sign.
Hmm.
Yeah, so later on it would be, you know, there was an episode of Doctor Who that alluded to it. I mean, tons of stuff, like a Neil Gaiman story. My favorite Grant Morrison would bring it up. And then I would also find out that, and we've talked about this, but the back rooms, you know, sort of the... Mm-hmm. The
creepypasta stuff.
Kind of creepypasta, yeah. Sort of like internet folklore, whatever. Some people say that like the yellow wallpaper in the back rooms is sort of an allegory for saying that Carcosa is the back rooms, which is pretty amazing. Like that's super cool. So I just wanted to bring that up because I feel like for our sort of like fan base, even though it's sort of hard to pin down, it's just something that's like fascinating. And I think it's really cool. I'm going to end with this. So in Robert W. Chambers' book, The Yellow King, it kicks off with something called Casilda Song. And it goes like this. Along the shore, the cloud waves break. The twin suns sink behind the lake. The shadows lengthen in Carcosa. Strange is the night where black stars rise and strange moons circle through the skies, but stranger still is lost Carcosa. Songs that the Hyades shall sing, where flap the tatters of the king, must die unheard in dim Carcosa. Song of my soul, my voice is dead, die thou unsung as tears unshed shall dry and die in lost Carcosa.
Dang.
It's amazing, right? And that's all we know of this forgotten, ancient, lost land of Carcosa where this, you know, god king in yellow lives. But there's something about it that's just fascinating. Like that it's just...
It's very our show for sure.
Yeah, you see what I mean?
You know,
yeah.
It blends things from like pop culture to lore and different types of horror that, you know, I actually haven't read any of the Lovecraft books at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a whole new world of stuff that I'm not even, like just as an example, I remember watching True Detective and just kind of being like, wait, what's going on here? Like,
yeah,
but, you know, and I still, to this day, I need to rewatch it now. I have no idea if it ends up being something sort of paranormal or whatever.
Well, or
if it's just normal people.
What's so perfect?
Here we go.
God almighty. What's so perfect?
Hard to tell what's perfect when you're coughing through it. Go ahead.
It really is. What's so perfect about even just how sort of these like little, you know, veiled allusions to the King in Yellow or the Yellow King or Carcosa, that's actually exactly how it should be done because it's so obscure and sort of, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, it really kind of invokes that. Anxiety because
you don't know anything about it.
What they're talking
right.
about. Yeah, that's so cool.
And then there's also something. So when I was researching, no, it's not. I'm almost done. It, you know, there's also ties with like the like Hastur, the great old one, and like the King in Yellow. There's references to like worship of like the god Kronos and like Saturn and like. All that gets super into like secret societies and stuff. But then also there's a connection to the god Pan. which all things come back to, you know, Pan.
This is little freaking Pan the Man. Yeah,
it's weird. Anyway,
Rufio.
Oh, God, that's the best.
I think the moral of the story here, folks, and we talk about it on our Instagram a lot, read more books. You never know where you're going to find inspiration.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, there's All Quiet on the Western Front. I read that in high school. It's blowing up the Oscar nominations right now. And so anyways, read more books. Now, can we please
get
into my time?
After these messages, we'll be right back.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
America's future can be determined by our dreams and our visions.
It was very intense, bright light.
For over 200 years, there have been reports of giant, man-like creatures.
From another dimension, another world, I don't know.
The most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
This is Joshua Cutchin, and you're at my home for weirdness. That would be rad.
All right, man. Finally, I get to talk about what I got ready for the show today. Mm-hmm. I have been wanting to talk about this for a long time. And when we were kind of trying to decide what we wanted to do this week, both Tyler and I were like, I said, hey, man, what do you think about this? And for some reason, when this happens, then we just kind of like change any and all plans, except for Tyler, who talks about True Detective for too long.
Hey, man.
And we're just like, we have to do this because of the synchronicity. But today, we're talking about this insane mystery that the further I sort of dove into it, the stranger it got, my decisions on what I think happened changed multiple times. And it's a story that I wanted all of you, if you're not familiar with it, to hear about.
Yeah, real quick. When Woody was like, hey, I think we should do this, we had been talking and, or no, I guess we were texting, maybe. And I, you know, we both have like, you know, in our notes and our phone of like, you know, show ideas. And I was like, well, maybe we should do this. Maybe we should cover this. And he was like, well, what if we do this? And I was like, oh my God, dude. And I took a screenshot, sent it to him. And it's exactly like the next thing that I was going to say. So it was sort of like, yeah, that's synchronicity.
So today we're going to talk about the mystery of Casper Hauser. It was early morning, May 1828, when a young boy staggered unnoticed through the streets of Nuremberg. The 16-year-old boy's boots were so damaged that his blistered feet were bursting through them. It didn't take long for people to notice this strange sight and inform the police, who then took the odd boy in for questioning. But there was a problem. The boy could barely speak. He was, however, carrying an envelope inside of which there were two anonymous letters. The first letter was written by someone who claimed that he found the boy at his doorstep on October 7th, 1812, and that he was kept in his home the entire time and was never allowed to leave. The letter suggested that the boy should become a cavalryman, or if not, quote, if he isn't good for anything, the captain must either kill him or hang him in the chimney. The second letter, written in the same hand, claimed to be from his mother and said that his father was a cavalryman in the 6th Regiment and had died. When the police began to guide his hand to make an X on the police report, the boy was able to write a single name, Caspar Hauser. When they examined him, they found that he acted like a child, but was clearly neither a fool or a madman. He could barely speak any words and wouldn't eat any food except for bread and water. Apparently, by the way, dude, apparently he, like, they offered him meat and vegetables and stuff, but he just basically would eat the bread. You know, Caspar, if you can hear us, wherever you are, I'm right there for you, man. Carbs for life.
Yeah, all right.
So he couldn't really speak, although one of the phrases that he could apparently say was, "I want to be a cavalryman as my father was." Interesting. Caspar seemed to have no sense of how to behave in a civilized society. For example, he burned his fingers touching a candle as if he didn't even know what it was and was fascinated by his own reflection in a mirror. The police didn't know what to do with him at the time, so he was arrested for vagrancy and was placed in jail. The city kept him in custody, and eventually he was taken in by a man named Frederick Dahmer, a schoolmaster who taught Caspar how to communicate.
Jeffrey's great-great-great-grandpa. Yeah.
I feel like there was another Dahmer recently.
Oh, really?
Anyway, now able to talk, the boy could finally tell his strange story. Caspar claimed to have been raised in a prison cell by a mysterious man whose face he never saw. His keeper provided him with bread and water, a wool blanket, and a few toys. Then one day, the man made Caspar stare at the ground while he brought him to the outskirts of Nuremberg, handed him these letters, and left him to fend for himself. So Frederick Dahmer worked with him and helped him to learn to read and write and especially draw, which Caspar apparently had a natural talent for. This is Tyler. Mm-hmm. During this time, he became a little bit of a celebrity. Newspapers all over Europe began reporting about him, and he became kind of like the hot subject among common folks and aristocrats all across Europe. Obviously, rumors began to circulate about his true origin, the most popular of which was that he was the crown prince of the Grand Duchy of Baden. Mm-hmm. Not sure what that means, but okay. But there were also rumors of him being a member of the royal house of Hungary and even England. Mm. For the next year and a half, the strange story kind of seemed to end. But things are about to get even more weird. In October of 1829, Caspar was found by his teacher, Dahmer, with a wound on his forehead, like a cut across his forehead. Caspar told him that he'd been attacked by the man who had held him prisoner and brought him to Nuremberg. This led to more public speculation about his royal origins. However, skeptics said it was his way of getting out of an argument with Mr. Dahmer, who had found him telling repeated lies. Alarmed officials called for a police escort and transferred him to the care of Johann Bieberbach, who was a municipal authority. Now, real quick, in all of this sort of research about this, about Caspar Hauser, you'll kind of notice this pattern. All of you armchair detectives out there will notice this pattern. He'll live with a family, mm-hmm. and the community will kind of support him. I mean, tons of members of the community basically supported him, paid for his schooling, clothing, you know, food, all that kind of stuff. He would stay in a place, and then eventually the relationship would kind of get a little strained, and there would be some arguments, and then something would happen, and he would go somewhere else, okay? So this is the first of it, mm-hmm. right? So Dahmer sees this wound on his forehead. He's like, what's going on? And the officials, you know, of the city kind of didn't know what to believe because, again, this is such a fantastic sort of situation that they're like, look, if it was this original person that dropped you off, we need to kind of like get you to somewhere safe. Now this person knows where you are, and so we're going to get you somewhere safe. So that's whenever he went into the care of Johann Bieberbach. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then, less than a year later, Caspar was wounded again. But this time, he accidentally shot himself.
Oh boy.
It was April 3rd, 1830. The Bieberbachs hear this pistol shot go off in Hauser's room. Bieberbeck runs to the room to find Casper bleeding from a wound in the right side of his head. Mm. Now, Casper's version of the story was that he climbed up on a chair to get some books. The chair kind of wiggled, wobbled, and finally fell. And then when he was trying to find a good place to grab a handhold, he had mistakenly torn down this pistol that was hanging on the wall, which caused it to go off. Now, there are doubts whether the superficial wound was actually caused by the shot. Some authors have basically, again, associated this incident with another argument in which he and Bieberbach had been arguing about these supposed lies.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless, again, it was pretty clear that this relationship with the Bieberbach family had kind of soured. So again, the municipal authorities transferred him to another house, this time a Baron von Tucher. And that was in May of 1830. But you guessed it, the Baron also would later complain about Casper's exorbitant vanity and lies, and his stay there didn't last long. In late 1831, a British nobleman named Lord Stanhope took an interest in Hauser and gained custody of him. And he actually ended up spending a lot of money attempting to kind of clarify Hauser's origin. Listen to this. He paid for two visits to Hungary, hoping to kind of jog the boy's memory. You know, maybe his theory basically being like, look, if I take him to Hungary, maybe I can kind of like show him around. Maybe it will be
like seeing, you know, his homeland will.
Exactly. Sort of like, in a sense, like retracing those steps, triggering those memories, right, to kind of come back was what he was hoping for. And he took him to Hungary primarily because, for the most part, Casper seemed to remember some Hungarian words and had once actually even declared the Hungarian countess, Matheny, was his mother. Here's the thing, though. When he took him there, Casper actually failed to recognize any of the buildings or monuments in Hungary. Like, not a one. A Hungarian nobleman who had met with Hauser, or Casper, I know I keep on interchanging that, mm-hmm, it could be confusing there. A Hungarian nobleman who had met with Casper later told Sir Stanhope that he and his son had a good laugh when they recollected the strange boy and his weird behavior. Stanhope later wrote that the complete failure of these inquiries led him to doubt Casper's credibility altogether. In December 1831, he transferred Hauser to Ansbach to the care of a schoolmaster named Johann George Meyer. And in January of 1832, Stanhope left Casper for good. Although he continued to pay for his living expenses, but never did make good on his promise to take him to England. Finally, this is the final strange incident, really, about 4 years later. So he lasted a little bit longer than typical, but it was December of 1833. Casper Hauser burst through the front door of his home with a serious wound on his side. Frantically, he tried to explain what had just happened. He was in the park, minding his own business, when a mysterious man approached him, handed him a letter, stabbed him, and then ran away. Now, this letter was a little different than any of the other ones.
Time travel.
This one was written backwards. Now, here's where it gets a little weird, and I kind of tend to
love it.
Partially agree with you. It was written backwards and in the same handwriting as the first two letters he came to town with.
Mm.
3 days later, Casper led an expedition to the spot where he was stabbed, but collapsed halfway there and died. That was December 17th, and it is believed he was about 21 years old when that happened. In the letter, which is very strange, it's a note written backwards so that it's legible in a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, it's real hard. I searched so hard to try to find translations of these letters. But I did find a picture of this letter, and essentially some of the translation says this, quote, Hauser will be able to tell you quite precisely how I look and from where I am. To save Hauser the effort, I want to tell you myself from where I come. There's some illegible writing.
Yeah.
And it says, I come from, and then there's some scribbles, the Bavarian border, some other stuff, on the river. I will even tell you the name. And then the initials, M-L-O. Now, after Casper died, nearly all of his benefactors came out against him. In fact, Lord Stanhope, the British guy that he kind of was essentially kind of his financial benefactor toward the end there, published a book with all the known evidence about Casper, concluding that it was his duty openly to confess that he had been deceived.
You mean Stanhope had been deceived?
Yep, okay. Yep. Likewise, an attorney named Feuerbach, who defended him, wrote that Casper Hauser is a smart, scheming codger, a rogue, a good-for-nothing that ought to be killed.
Jeez.
Controversy and speculation about his origin didn't end with his death. For decades after, there were articles and books being written about Casper Hauser. So, here's the thing. To this day, no one knows who this guy was, where he came from, but there are a few theories.
We'll return after these messages.
You have one new message.
Hey guys, this is John from Pennsylvania. I was just listening to the newest episode, loved it as usual, and it made me think of my own experience with unexpected blood. I was waking up one morning, coming down to my kitchen to get ready for work, and as usual, I'm bumbling through the house in complete darkness. I get to the fridge, and I open the refrigerator door, and when I do that, I see that down at my feet, which is now illuminated, there is blood everywhere, all around my feet. I'm standing in it, my socks have it in, and I have this moment of slight freak out where I'm not sure what's happening. I stumble over to the kitchen light, turn it on, and that's when I see that there are the remains of a mouse spread all over my kitchen floor that my cats have taken care of during the night. So nothing supernatural there, but man, it was bizarre and had me thinking of it. And I couldn't actually believe that there was that much blood inside a mouse. So the next 20 minutes were spent scrubbing the floor.
Hey, thanks so much, John, for leaving us that that voicemail on our answer machine, man. That is, I definitely would have been, if I was scared of kind of puddles of water whenever I woke up, I can't even imagine what I would have done if it was blood.
Yeah, I really thought that was going in a more tragic direction, but thank God it was just a mauled and massacred little mouse.
And now, back to our show. All right, so here are some of the theories. For many years, one of the theories, there were tons of people who believed that he was, in fact, a long-lost prince who supposedly died as an infant in 1812, the same year Casper was born. But that just kind of turned out to be a coincidence because in 1996, this is so funny that you, earlier in the show, talked about DNA tests proving things and all that. In 96, DNA tests proved that Casper Hauser had no relation to the royal family that was in question at that point. So
yeah,
that theory's gone.
That's cool. But wait, what wasn't there like possible, like several different sort of...
There was like, that's the thing. As I kind of dug into this, his story changed a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, that was the one that was like kind of closest to what, you know, what it could have been, that there was an infant that died in 1812, the same year he was born. But then they did that DNA test and figured out that, nope, he's not related to them whatsoever.
Mm.
So really, then I'd say the next sort of, or the only mainstream theory that is kind of left after that, essentially, is that Casper was an imposter who made it all up in order to gain fame and fortune. Many experts believe that Casper himself wrote the first letters the day he was found and then completely fabricated his backstory. And then also, the seemingly random attacks on him may not have been so random either. All three times that Casper was supposedly wounded by an unseen attacker, it came just a day or two after someone had questioned his story.
Hmm.
The attacks were likely self-inflicted and designed as a way to avoid suspicion and gained sympathy when people started to question his story. Even the final attack may also have been self-inflicted. I read somewhere that where he was stabbed is just, it's seemingly sort of like an accidental sort of fatal wound. Like he just stabbed himself right in the main artery and he was like, oh, you know, he wouldn't have known it.
Yeah. To me, it's a little weird that like when he first showed up, basically it said that, you know, they were asking him questions and he would just wail, like, don't know. And like horse. But then, you know, and then it said that he made motions to his feet. They took his shoes off. There's blisters all over. And then I guess someone thought like, oh, well, let's give him a pin. And like, you know, to their surprise, he perfectly writes Casper Hauser. This is also interesting that I just ran across. They remember the letter that he was carrying and cracked it open. Its only heading was from the Bavarian border. The place is unnamed, 1828. There was an additional letter tucked into the first that confirmed the boy's name was Casper. And he was born April 30th, 1812. And then there was like an envelope full of gold dust. Did you see that?
I didn't see that. No. I mean, it's interesting too. Like apparently like the second one is supposedly from his mom, but it was the same handwriting.
Well, yeah. Well, it says that when they searched him, they found various fine handkerchiefs with the initials KH embroidered in red. His hat was lined with dun, 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 yellow silk, king in yellow.
Oh, man.
And he had an envelope full of gold dust. He was also carrying religious text and a rosary made from animal horn. It's weird. What a weird...
It is very strange, man. I mean, some people have said, you know, like maybe he had like Munchausen syndrome and he was just like making up this, false identity and this tragic story to get sympathy and also to basically get a free ride.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, there's a lot of other details that make that strange. Like apparently like his feet were very like... they could tell that he didn't really like travel much, right? He had like softer feet. And I know they were like covered in blisters and stuff whenever he first came about. But it's like, I wonder then where he did originate.
Like, yeah, where did he go?
You know?
From? Yeah.
You know, obviously, my mind for fun initially goes to, of course, time traveler, right? Mm-hmm. Or someone from another dimension, or like someone from somewhere else kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And it's like...
A man out of time.
Right, a man out of time, or, you know, maybe part of the reason why his captor was, a mysterious figure, someone that didn't show his face or something like that, was because it was like his future self or something. You know, and that's like just really kind of thinking out of the box. I mean, the easy answer for me, especially since like you dive in a little bit deeper, you start reading about the people that were taking care of him and the fact that they would kind of show him this, show him that, or like his story would just change in the middle of it. And they would like confront him about that. And then that's when something would happen. Like, I mean, it does follow this pattern of him just being a straight up imposter.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
It's one of those things that I don't think there's really a way of us knowing, you know, because it was so long ago, but it's like, it's weird because it sounds to me like when he first shows up, you know, he can only say like a few things, like horse, it's like he has sort of, you know, he's sort of mentally disabled in a way. But then it says, oh, well, let's give him a pin. And he like perfectly writes his name. I just wonder, like, because it doesn't really say like in the research, like, did he eventually like start speaking, you know, like a normal man? Or?
Yeah. So one of the things that I read about was how, you know, with that first teacher that he stayed with, who was teaching him to read and write and all this, they first made a note that was like, wow, like he's like taken to it really quickly. You know what I mean? Yeah. And like, oh man, like this has got to be some kind of miracle. Well, you know, kind of looking back over it, you're kind of like, well, did he learn it quickly or is he just faking the whole time?
Yeah, that's weird. I mean, and I wonder too, like all the, you know, like the acts, you know, quote unquote, possible accidental, mm-hmm. you know, like the gunshot to his head and like, I don't know. It's such a bizarre story. I mean,
the hard part too is it's like late 1800s.
Right.
And so like, you know, and, you know, we don't have any of the like sort of investigative reports about, you know, where did the bullet end up? Was the angle
right.
even realistic for that to be a reality that, oh, it just grazed his head? Or did he just like kind of cut himself on the forehead?
Yeah, right.
And then there's just like a bunch of stuff that's kind of weird. Now, here's an interesting fact about it all is that I didn't know this until literally this morning, so I haven't seen it. But, you know, Werner Herzog, the writer, director, he was also in The Mandalorian.
Yep, he's awesome.
If you watch it, he's the guy that hires Mando to go and get Baby Yoda.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing how beautiful Beskar can be when forged by its ancestral artisans. Can I offer you a libation to celebrate the closing of our shared narrative?
Yeah, he is, he's awesome.
Yeah,
he's awesome. I love that guy. But he did a movie called The Enigma of Caspar Hauser. It came out in 1974.
Oh.
And I haven't watched it yet,
man.
But it is available on Tubi to stream.
I'm watching it right now.
Not to just promote a movie that I don't know much about, but here are some of the, here's what some of the reviews on IMDb have to say. Mm-hmm. All right, the IMDb rating averages around 7.7 out of 10. But someone says, one of my top 10 films of all time.
What?
Herzog has a way of documenting history as if it was our own past that we are reliving. It all seems strangely familiar, yet slightly surreal. The film is rich with detail of the period, which is the 19th century, yet it's not the slightest bit in your face like so many of the current period films that seem to be about nothing more than lush furniture and people who sit on them. Okay, this one's a 9 out of 10. A dark, mysterious, real, discerning, and instinctive character study. It's pretty cool. Strange masterpiece by master filmmaker. So anyway, it looks... I mean, now I got to watch it. I want to see kind of how it unfolds. But I mean, I've always found, I heard about this and I don't even remember how, I think it was on like one of those sort of mystery YouTube channels that is for kids. And I think my oldest like asked me, hey, have you ever heard of this? And I'm like, what? No.
Yeah.
And it's like a 5-minute video or something like that.
Now I totally see, by the way, while you brought up The Green Children of Woolpit. Which that's a future episode, but it's I can see the sort of connections.
Yeah, the connection, right? Like it's that sort of like wandering children into a town sort of thing. It's always been fascinating. I mean, look at stories like The Jungle Book, you know, or any of the like Hansel and Gretel. Anytime there's like kids and
they just sort of pop out of nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. Man, it's very very weird. And interesting, too.
So I wonder if, I heard about this story not like a long time ago, but in the last few years. And I remember thinking like I didn't realize how many different sort of like turnovers that the kid had, which that's the thing that sort of leads me to believe that like, I don't know, maybe there was a little shadiness. Because I guess he went to stay with this person. And then this person, and then they all like basically kicked him out.
Yeah, and it's according to them, it was always following this sort of, you know, anytime he felt like he was going to be found out. You know, this is again assumptions that we're making long after the fact, but it's hard not to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And as much as I want this to be like some crazy time traveling tale. Man, I don't know.
Although there is one part of it that that I don't know, that sort of like piques my like hope and like, well, maybe there was something weird. How they say that like he spoke in like the old Bavarian dialect, which had long since like disappeared. Which I think that if he was like, you know, I don't know how else to say it, but like if he was like one of the sort of like the feral child trope, if he was that, then that would kind of make sense. So maybe this person that was keeping him in a cage, he was a super old guy, you know, he would have been the only person that Hauser would have been able to like, you know, pick up on his language. So maybe he spoke in the old Bavarian dialect out in the woods, off the grid. I don't know. There's something about that that seems interesting to me. But didn't that story came that he told about him being, I guess, kept kind of like prisoner. That came mm-hmm. like much later, right?
No, that was right out
of the gate. Oh, right out of the gate, he said that. Oh, well,
yeah. And what's interesting, too, I just thought of this. You know, like, let's all kind of give Caspar Hauser the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
And let's, for a minute, together, collectively, believe that he really was a time traveler. Now, I just thought of this because it's like anybody, I'll just, with my own kids, okay? Mm-hmm. There are times when they're trying to either describe something, or maybe you think as the parent, like they're hiding something from you, and then like, no, they're actually telling the truth. But all of the questions that you're asking them are like leading you to believe, like, wait a minute here, what, you know? And then you're like, oh, okay, Urata did leave my wallet in my, you know what I
right,
mean?
Right.
Like, maybe this person, Caspar Hauser, did come from some, or forget about time travel. Let's just say that it was just like he really was held captive, you know?
Yeah.
And he didn't really know how to speak and all this kind of stuff. Perhaps his memories were kind of weird. Like, would he be able to recall Hungarian freaking, you know, landmarks and stuff if he was kept in a room for 16 years?
Yeah.
You know? Would he be able to, like, his story might sound different because the details maybe would change a little bit. Mm. You know, it really kind of calls into question like a little bit more sort of study and the psychological effects of someone who's been held captive
right.
that long. You know, I don't really know of, or off the top of my head, I can't think of any cases that where someone was held captive for such a long time, you know, and then released. And it wasn't sort of like a, you know, imposter or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, the one that, the first thing I think of is like the Elizabeth Smart gal who was like kidnapped by that dude, took her out of the window. And then, you know, for a long time, you know, the parents were under investigation because people thought that they maybe killed her. But it come to find out this guy like had kept her and like made her wear like the, like a facial covering kind of thing. So that she wouldn't, and I think, I don't remember how long that was that she was held captive.
Such a weird thing.
It is weird, man. And, you know, there are moments when I think she even kind of sided with the captor. And I don't know. It's just interesting. So, like, if this wasn't an imposter, would it be a situation where these people were, I mean, God, this is actually sad. What if he was mentally handicapped mm-hmm. and on top of it just kind of like, again, guys, this is 1830s, right? Wait, no, this is before that. 1821, 20, yeah. right? Yeah. Or 1828 when he staggered into town. Mm-hmm. This is 1828. Imagine maybe perhaps his parents didn't really know how to take care of someone that had special needs.
Right. Yeah.
He kind of pieces information together and then, you know, maybe he was high functioning, but also had some issues. Now he's going from house to house. These people are like, well, why don't you tell, you know, they're getting frustrated at him. He perhaps doesn't have the skill set to communicate in a way that they find to be truthful, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you know what I'm saying? Like,
well,
Well, that's an option that's kind of like sad.
Yeah.
That I think about as a possibility.
Well, it's kind of like those sort of stories or sort of the theory. Oddly enough, Joshua Cutchin talks about this some, but it's that idea that, like, you know, when these people years and years and years ago would claim that their child had been taken and replaced with, like, a changeling, you know, and they would, like, do these horrible things with it, dunking it in water to, like, bring their, you know, quote unquote, bring their other child back. You know, his thing is like, well, like, how many of these cases could possibly be like, you know, they started seeing like the markings of like, you know, like autism or like Down syndrome or, and so these people are like, oh, well, this is not my kid. This is something else. And then they do these unspeakable things, you know, to get their real kid back. So it's like kind of like what you're saying. It's like if he did have sort of mental issues, then like was it just people that didn't have the patience for it? So they're just like, oh, he's you know, fake or whatever, and then they just sort of kick him out.
Yeah.
One thing that is interesting to me, and again, it goes back sort of to the Green Children of Woolpit, is the, which to me, this lends a little credibility that he wasn't a scammer. He wasn't, it wasn't like a put on. So if you think like in the 1820s, you know, this kid shows up in town, he kind of seems to have some issues. They go on to give him beer and sausage and he spits it out. It says throughout his entire life, all that he would eat was plain bread and water, which to me, he's really going for it to try to sell this, because back then it's like, you know, food was, I would imagine, was a little more sparse than it is now. So it's like if they're giving him, you know, beer and like sausage, those are more sort of high end, you know, food offerings. And the fact that he's just spitting them out and he refuses to eat any of that, it reminds me of the Children of Woolpit, because it says they didn't eat for like 3 days until finally they came across like some sort of like bean or like a raw bean or raw pea or something. And that's all that they would eat. So it's I don't know. It's kind of, there's some sort of correlation between those two in that way, you know?
Yeah. And like if potentially he came from another world dimension,
something
like that, then he wouldn't be used to like our foods or whatever.
Yeah. Right. I don't know. To me, that sells it a little more, because if it is fake, that's some dedication to only eat water and bread.
Yeah.
You know.
And to like, I don't know. There's just so much about this. It's weird. And I'm super interested to hear what you, the listener, thinks about it. Was this guy just like a straight up imposter? Mm-hmm. It also reminds me of, there's a documentary about this kid who goes missing in the 80s from this family. Mm-hmm. And
oh, you told me about this.
I mean, I think I want to say he's gone something like, and this is just on the top of my head, so if I'm wrong, we'll fact check it later or something. Mm-hmm. But I think it's something like 10 years.
Wow.
Just missing. The family refuses to believe that, you know, anything's happened to him. They never find a body. They never find anything. So they don't know what happened.
Yeah.
Okay. Then a guy is found in, and I want to say like France or something, okay, overseas. And he gets brought in by the police. And when they ask him, you know, what's your name? He gives this kid's name. And he goes into this story about how he was, you know, kidnapped and he was brought over here and has been living and finally he escaped or whatever. And then this guy is brought back to the States. Mm-hmm. You know, the family accepts him and is just like overjoyed that he's back. And then,
oh boy,
like come to find out, like the dude is like this French con artist guy who, you know,
you just heard about it on the news.
Dude doesn't even look like he could be a 16 or 18 year old. This dude's got like, he's like 5 o'clock shadow style, definitely 25.
Wow.
Dyed his hair blonde, which is the same color as this kid. Dude, it's unbelievable. Which then calls into question, now, were the family just so sort of, I don't know, delusional or something, or blinded by the joy that this was their son potentially?
I mean,
you know what I mean? Like, would you, like, separate 10 years from the time you see your child, 10 years later, would you just be like, oh, it's them, you know? Or did they do something bad to this kid? And then they just kind of like went along with it because like, oh God.
So it sort of took the view away from them, like the spotlight.
Yeah, very strange.
And that kind of reminds me of that Pauline Picard, which that's another one that's weird. It's like same kind of thing. And I'm sure we'll do another episode where we really dive into these stories, but it's like, you know, this little girl goes missing, Pauline, her family is, you know, grief stricken, and they ended up finding her like 200 miles away or whatever, in an orphanage or something maybe. Ends up getting her back. A couple years later, somebody ends up finding remains of Pauline Picard. Meanwhile, they've been keeping this other random girl for like 4 years. And so I see what you mean. It's like, I feel like I, as a parent, would be like, yeah, this kid may look similar, but like, this isn't my child. But I mean, but then again, I guess like, you're also kind of thinking like, well, maybe there was like some sort of like, you know, massive amount of like trauma. So it's like changed them, you know, personality wise.
Well, first off, this guy, I mean, it's not even, dude, you're going to laugh so hard. When you see, like, imagine me trying to like pass myself off as like a pale, blue eyed, blonde kid.
Jesus.
And just being like, hey, mom. And also, hey, throw in the French accent. Hey, I can't do a French accent, but hey, mumé. I don't even know.
Yeah.
That's terrible. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, it's so ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like the parents, like, I don't know, maybe they're, I mean, same with him and Picard. Like, it's like, are they just so overjoyed that they've like found the kid that they're just sort of like looking beyond like logic, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. And it, you know, kind of bring it full circle back here. At the end of the day, because whether it was self-inflicted or by a maniac, because he was stabbed in the leg and it was a mortal wound, unfortunately, we'll never know. All we can kind of go by are the kind of accounts and the stories that the people who took care of them have sort of given us.
Right.
All in all, it's such an interesting story. If he was a time traveler, if he was an imposter, if he was an imposter, no matter which angle you look at it, it's super interesting. Like, if he was, in fact, an imposter, how did he know that he wasn't just going to get, like, beat up? The only thing I can think of is like, what would make you that desperate to just like leave it all behind and just create this story and not get caught by the people you left? I mean, you're 16, right? So that tells me that like, okay, he was an orphan of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Did he, going back to the true crime, did he kill the family and then just wander off so that he could start over?
But again, I can't, like, I think you can't look past, like, okay, if he was an orphan and kind of out on his own, like, if he's, it's just that, like, oh, I'm fine. I'll just have bread and water my whole life from here on in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. I just keep going back to that. Like, that's hard to.
Well, see, my thought is maybe he wasn't as, like.
Like, hardcore about
maybe
it.
He didn't like starve himself. I mean, I couldn't find anywhere where they described that he looked like, you know, emaciated in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's like, he just kind of is. I just picture this dude, if he was an imposter, he's like some 16-year-old drinking beer somewhere in Bavaria and, you know, and then eating sausages and all this. And he's like, yeah, I'm bored. He walks a little way or far enough to where his feet would be, you know, he has some blisties.
Mm-hmm.
That reminds me of Andy from The Office when he goes and like,
oh yeah,
they're supposed to like do this like big business deal, and he goes the night before, and he's like, the guy goes to shake his hand, he's like, ooh, sorry, I hit about 150 balls yesterday, getting ready and I got some blisties. And he like shows his hands as they're just like raw. But anyway, this kid comes in, he's got blisters all over his feet. And I can, yeah, just, no, bread's good. Cause it's just like, you know, he's just trying to sober up, man. Past the Gatorade.
Well, this said, you know, for me, for, like, that's all that he ate that anybody knew. Like from then on, like all the different, you know, I mean, it says like for the rest of his life, I guess, which that's what I'm saying. It's like, that's like, that's a lot of dedication to mm-hmm. sell this story. There's so many sort of conflicting things about it that like, I mean, there's definitely a con artist kind of vibe, but then again, I don't know, like maybe he was like trauma induced, you know, and just kind of sort of socially, you know, awkward. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, though, for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, man, unfortunately, we'll never know.
Yep. Yep. We will never know. Well, folks, if you know more about the story or have seen the Werner Herzog's 1978 movie, we'd love to hear about it. Feel free to drop a comment on our Instagram. Shoot us a DM if you want to talk to us about anything or tell us a story, urban legend. If it's more long form, shoot it over to thatwouldberadpod@gmail.com. But even better than all those is our website, which is thatwouldberadpodcast.com, where you can, you know, directly leave a voice memo of maybe a local urban legend or a ghost story or a paranormal event or, you know, situation that you found yourself in. We'd love to hear about it. That's like our favorite thing. Get out there, give us 5-star reviews. Go tell one friend that's into weird stuff in your life. We know that they'll appreciate it. And I guess that's about it. Oh, for those folks that are our Rabbit Trail patrons, again, we are always so thankful for you guys. We have big things going on. And if That Would Be Rad is not enough, if you just gotta get more, go be like all of our other best friends and sign up for the Rabbit Trail, our Patreon. We would be so thankful, so grateful for it if you do. There's a bunch of stuff happening over there. And it's just where we can kind of relax, get a little loosey-goosey and, you know, turn down the lights, you know, have a drink and just kind of just talk, ramble. You got anything else, Woody?
Man, I think that's it. No.
Cool, bro. Well, we love you. We appreciate you. And as always,
be rad.
That's the way it goes. My favorite song on the radio.
clouds in a time where I just needed some sunshine. You were already dead before you became a ghost. You always said our future would be a parade of flowers, but now all that's left is a single rose. That's the way.
Okay, guy.
The man in the yellow hat, George of the Jungle.
Dude, it's
or
so
not,
cool.
What is
man.
It? What is George? Not George of the Jungle.
Yeah. No. Curious George.
Curious George. I hate
Curious dude, George of the Jungle.
I don't like any kind of cartoons that have like that pain in the character.
Yeah.
And one of the most famous ones that I, of course, only heard about because of my name, Woody the Woodpecker.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hate it.
My kids all, love like, that movie, though.
Dude, I can't stand it. I know my kids did too, I think, whenever they saw it. I hate that dang character, man, because not only did I just hear the stupid sound all the time, when I was growing up, but also, you know, you're moving around a lot, you get to a new school, and they're like, oh, what's your name? And you're like, Woody, and you hear somebody, I'm like, cool.
I mean, it's like me when I say my actual first name is Dennis, so it was always like, oh, Dennis the Menace. It's like, boy, never heard that before.
Good morning, Mr. Benz. Okay. Oh.